Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From PCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Well, the absolutely mind-boggling Richard Price is with me. His new novel, Lush Life, you know, each time it's like poison for me. Because officially, you know, I don't like thrillers or police procedure. I don't like any of it. You know, it's not for me. And then I start to read your books, and it's the profusion of language and setting and detail and time and character, and it's registered simultaneously and makes me think that you have the metabolism of a hummingbird, that your responsiveness to an environment is so intense that not only are you capable of figuring out how to write sentences that tell you everything at once, I have the suspicion that you register it all at once, too. Can you give me an idea of how that's done?
Well, I mean, one of the tricks is to maintain your sense of awe at what you're experiencing. And one of the ways you do that is, I think Andre Gide said, the only way to write about Africa is to go there for 10 days or 10 years. So I'm one of those 10-day big-eyed guys. When I go out, the other thing, too, is to be a little afraid of what you're doing, because terror keeps you slender. I mean, if you feel like, I don't know if I can capture this, and that means you're going to bring everything to the table. And so it's a double awe. One is like, I can't believe I'm seeing this. The other one is, I don't know if I have the chops to capture this. You know, and it's not as easy as it looks. I promise you that.
It doesn't look easy.
It's a hummingbird that starts flying like a frigate bird, you know. But at the end, you know, it looks pretty quick.
The book is called Lush Life. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And somewhere in its depths, there's a character who tells us why he likes New York. After all, he has fantasies sometimes of being a photographer and the opportunities for the anomalous to appear. He says that you can read about when the circus is bringing its elephant through the tunnel. And even though he got the wrong tunnel, still the possibility of being able to photograph that elephant is reason enough to live there. And I think that's true of this prose, too, that what might come through the tunnel at any moment is so surprising and so funny and, you know, astounds the characters. Now, all of these characters have got themselves to have that kind of extreme metabolism, because whether they're police watching for what's happening at the periphery of a scene or a bartender who has to get a sense of what the bouncer at the door can't handle, all these characters are having to look at more than what they know they're seeing, and you're having to write the sentences that tell you what's at the edge in addition to what's at the center of their perception. Now, that's a funny skill.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that all these characters are on the edge of being overwhelmed with perception, like you're saying. And I personally feel overwhelmed by them, you know, and I kind of bring that panic to the page. I mean, I think it serves me well, but it's kind of genuine, you know. There's a genuine anxiety that, you know, I'm anxious that I captured this character's anxiety, which makes, if it works, it's anxious with a cherry on top. But like I said, when I first started writing, my first four books were fairly self-referential, and you know, I couldn't go. I had written myself into a corner, and then in the course of writing screenplays for 8 years, actually learn something from screenplays as opposed to, you know, having something destroyed by screenplays. And that's that I can go out in the world and, if you want to find yourself, lose yourself. You know, it doesn't have to be about you literally. And it's like, what do you want to know about? What do you want to know? What intrigues you? What keeps you up at night? Go there and see what happens. And that's, you know, so I'm in that mood that you're trying to describe all the time.
Now, this book takes a huge risk. I believe that in the first third of the book, as you wrote, you didn't know perhaps whether Eric is going to be guilty of having killed his bartender acquaintance or whether it is a street thug. I think the book couldn't have been written if you did know, but it means that the moment you decided who was responsible, the book shuts down and has to start all over again.
Right.
And I was wondering about that risk, about picking a book up, because you've just had like a 40, 50-page Dostoevskian sequence in which a character is being broken down and he turns out, we've kind of been made aware of this, I'm not giving away secrets, but he turns out ultimately to be not the character we need to be focusing on for the plot. He's the character we need to be focusing on for the mood of this area of the city and what's right. happened to it. But he's not going to be the man the police are breaking down. And so we have to start again, just like the detective does. But what a risk to take with a novel.
Well, the only way to do that is to not be aware that you're doing that. I mean, you sort of know what you're doing. It's not like I didn't know whether he did it or not. But, I didn't think it through. I just saw the trajectory of this particular character. And he became the edge between sort of a promise and destruction, you know. And he tilted over. It's sort of like the betrayal of youth. It's the betrayal of optimism.
Guy's name is Eric Cash. He wanted to be an actor. He wants to be a screenwriter. He's published some short stories between C and D.
Alphabet City Literary Rag. Thinking of C and D.
Yeah. But he doesn't get to do any of it or most of it because most of us don't. And he's kind of anguished, jealous of the people who haven't lost their edge yet, you know, the people who think it will still happen to them because they annoy him and they remind him that it hasn't happened to him.
Well, they torment him.
Yeah. But aren't these the kind of people who are tormented by you?
Well, you know, the thing is I always look at this character. He's 35 years old, and he came down to the Lower East Side when he was in his early 20s. And down there, it's sort of like the tyranny of optimism, tyranny of youth. It's like everybody's going to live forever. Everybody's going to make it. We can take any crap job we want because it's just a means to an end. We're all going to walk down the carpet and pick up the Pulitzer in about 10 years, maybe sooner. So you do that job and you get hyphens connected to your name. Well, you know, I'm a waiter hyphen performance artist, or I'm a waitress hyphen playwright, you know, but you 10 years go by and the hyphen falls off and you're just a waiter and just a waitress, which is fine if that's what you want to be. Uh-huh. But life is what happens to you while you're waiting for your ship to come in. So Eric, to me, is the guy who at 35, you know, hanging on by his fingernails. And the way I thought about him is that I would have been him if I hadn't published The Wanderers very young, because if I had hung in and hung in and hung in, and if I didn't get published, I mean, that would have been me. I mean, in 1974, when I was 24 years old, if the Lower East Side was happening like it was in the last 10 years, I would have crawled on glass to live down there. And I would have been surrounded by like-minded people, also oblivious to all the other cultures around me, which is could be a deadly mistake, you know, ergo the book. But you know, it wouldn't even enter my mind. that I would be a maitre d' or a waiter, you know, passing out menus 10 years from now. You know, so, I mean, I try to create the ghost of Christmas future, you know, if I didn't get published.
Yeah, but what I mean is this. It seems obvious to me from the way you talk now that it was the way you talked then, and maybe even more so then. There was no chance in the world that you weren't a novelist. You know what I mean? Listen to the way you talk. Listen to the way your eye works, mm-hmm. and listen to the sentences you make naturally. So people who meet that person, the natural guy, who want to be writers and don't really understand that you have to be the natural guy. The actor is already the actor.
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
know, Al Pacino from off Broadway days has been being told all
Pablo
his life.
Hummel, yeah.
You're exactly. You're electric. You know, when the Indian wanted the Bronx in that Israel Horowitz play, when he said strudel
deuce. Yeah, I forgot about that one.
Yeah, strudel deuce, strudel day. He already had it. You know, you have to have it before you start. And I think that people who know that they're never going to have it, that are just going to have the desire, have that ferocious envy.
But, see, the thing is, like, I didn't know. I mean, part of the conundrum is, if you have it and you're natural and you just do it, you don't think about it because you're too busy doing it. So it never entered my head, you know. But the guy next to me could have been less talented and never entered his head too because we're both 23 and idiots, you know. And, you know, now looking back, you could say, wow, you know, this guy had chops when he was half his age. But at the time, I didn't see anything to differentiate myself from the other 15 idiots sitting around a seminar table at Columbia, you know. You know, some of us were going to sink and some of us were going to swim. I had no validation or anything. The other difference between myself and Eric Cash is I'm the author. He's the character,
right.
You know. But yeah. I could just as easily have been the character in somebody else's book.
But you see, when I see you, this time too, we've spoken together twice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think of Cubby Selby. And I think of the way Cubby didn't speak that way. He had a work, that incredible, cross-grained, coarse, amazing language in Last Exit to Brooklyn, up draft after draft after draft after draft, and he never really got it again. He never really had the patience to do that. What I see when I listen to you is someone who's capturing that rapidity, first crack off the bat, so subsequent drafts can fill in the mega details. So what I'm saying is that many people who have it once don't have it as naturally or as sumptuously as you do. Pardon me for the praise.
Or continuously. I mean,
yeah.
Well, Hubert Selby was anything. He wasn't a social realist whatsoever. He was a bebop improviser. I mean, the language in Last Exit to Brooklyn was, I mean, people forget and they think of it as, you know, authentic because he was writing about Red Hook Brooklyn, so therefore it's got to be some extension of Studs Lonergan. But if you look at that, that's more like Coltrane. But for people who write what I write, which is sort of photographically a little bit, and, you know, social realists, or, you know, the danger with social realists is that they have one great book in them. And it's their first. And they are healthy. And they're going to live for a long time. And they've got nothing else to say. You know, I mean, look at James Farrell. I mean, the guy wrote about 50 books after Studs Lonergan. You know? But that's part of the thing that sort of keeps me on my toes is that, I mean, I don't want to fall down. I want to keep going. So all of this gets into the hopper, you know, when I find something, you know, it's the whole, everything, it looks like those colors in like a thermal graph, you know, everything is kind of vivid and, you know, wavering at the outlines. Wherever I go, okay, you know, what's the new arena? Lower East Side. Oh my God, how am I going to do Lower East Side? It's like Byzantium. Well, you know, that's the mood I have to be in. If I go in there like I can phone it in, it's going to flop. I mean, I'm going to flop. I have to stay in love, you know.
I'm talking with Richard Price about his new novel, Lush Life, which is recently published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux. We'll return after this short break. ¶¶ I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Richard Price about his new novel, Lush Life. As I read, I recognized a strange decorum in this novel. In fact, for a place that's so crowded with a threat of violence, maybe a gun goes off twice in the book. There's very little in the way of rolling in it. You know, it's not a gore fest. It's to generate the feeling, the kinesis of that world. And it surprises me. Do you have an inner control? Because, you know, it's a big book, and it's being run. See, I think more than you know, you do bebop too, you know, and I don't think it's plot, and I don't really even think it's the height, the climax scene. I think you're great at starting stuff up, and you start things up over and over and over again, and it's why the book can start up again a third of the way in and take complete control of the reader all over again.
Well, you know, the thing about, you know, guns going off or cars going over the speed limit or anything like that, I don't see it that much. I mean, I feel like you don't need it that much. I mean, first of all, you know, just in terms of like violence and transgressions and stuff like that, I don't in any way consider myself a genre writer. I mean, I'm obviously using some of the stuff of the genre, but I feel like genre is the triumph of plot over character. You know, you read 10 books, you sort of like them all, but you can't tell the difference from one to the other. It's like, who did it? Who cares? You know, in my mind, I use a criminal investigation because I've got an extremely complicated landscape here, like I did in Clockers. And, you know, it's been said that a criminal investigation is a lazy man's way to a plot. And it is. You know, I figured, how on earth am I going to write about six universes? Six planets, all unfortunately on the same track, miraculously not colliding every minute. How am I going to write about all this, plus the seventh planet, which is the ghosts, in a way that doesn't feel like a travelogue? It's like, oh, wait, I forgot the Chinese. Got to get the Chinese in there. Here comes the Orthodox Jews. Oh, my God, I forgot about the Orthodox Jews. Sir, Chaim, will you wait a minute? Sir. And, you know, Mei Hong over there, man, would you just put down the vegetables? Hold on a second. I'll be with you in a minute. First step. You know, and I just figured the logic is, you know, the investigation of a crime is chronological. It's orderly. It's not always successful. There's a lot of dead ends, but everything has a purpose. There's a reason for doing everything. And I always feel like if you just take a little chip off the periphery of a world, it'll replicate and it'll reflect the whole world. And this way, you wind up writing about everybody in an indirect but pointed way, because it all comes back to the logic of the investigation. I have to talk to this guy, this Chinese guy now. Now I got to talk to this Israeli guy. I don't particularly want to. I think it's going nowhere, but, you know, these are the rules. I mean, the character is saying, and so the reader is saying, okay, I buy it, you know, and I'm getting away with not being Marlon Perkins, you know. But it's very tricky genre writing. I mean, the people that I like that would be considered genre writers are people that I consider those, you know, who transcend the genre. I mean, I like James Ellroy because he's James Ellroy, not because he writes, or George Pelicanos, or, you know, Dennis Lehane, or people like that. I mean, you know, I like them because, you know, they stepped off, they color outside the box, or outside the outlines, whatever you say. You know, I don't consider myself a writer like them. I mean, I'm going to use some of the same conventions that they use, but I mean, you know, look, I don't know, is American Tragedy a crime novel?
You mentioned Farrell and Dreiser, and I think of that flop sweat of writing, people who wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote with that kind of grisly belief that by staying at it, it gets deeper and deeper, and it may be a little bit dull in the moment, but if you keep going in, you'll get in. You know that you'll
get the document will be well worth the effort.
That's right. Yeah. Does that happen to you? Because I think of you in the tradition of that kind of Dreiser writing. You know.
No, I get deeply into that very earnest kitchen sink mentality, but that's why God invented editors, you know, and invented, you know, I'm looking at that, I'm covering all my bets. I mean, I've got this down. But then sometimes you got to step off and you say, well, this is sinking. I got to throw things overboard to make the boat go faster. So, I mean, my first impulse is anything I see is art. You know, and it's not true. You know, just because it happened, don't make it art. So there's a winnowing process. And then I look at the sentences. And then with this book, I think the two of the three books earlier than this, Clockers and Freedomland, were more like in those like doorstopper social realist kind of modes. I couldn't stop clicking that camera. This time, I mean, it's because I'm older. I kind of feel like I don't need to say it eight ways. When one will do, you know, I don't know if it's confidence or you know, impatience, but I made more snap decisions as opposed to like, you know, just in case you didn't get the despair. Let me hit you with three other variations on the theme, which you probably don't need. And if you didn't get it, these three will just drive you nuts anyhow. So,
well, saying it eight ways will. When one will do, sometimes works when you have a character who's trying to escape arrest, as you do in a section when a junkie gets picked up outside the bar for stealing a purse. It's been sitting, he says, just on the ground there while people were waiting. And hearing his variations on who he is a hilarious thing. A kind of showman's thing, not a realist thing, but an impresario's thing. Let's hear it.
It's the junkie's aria. This city, Lester Kaufman said, one knee crossed over the other, a cuffed hand dangling languidly from the restraint bar. People are doing so well, you know, but you can't ask them for squat anymore. It's never been so bad. Matty grunted in sympathy. The bouncer had told him that the first thing this guy had said when he grabbed him after the attempted purse snatch in front of Berkman's was, "Let me go and I'll tell you who shot that white kid." "I swear, man," Lester said to Matty for the 10th time in the last half hour, "I just said that like in a panic, like the first thing that came into my head, what's left of my head." Unfortunately, Matty believed him. Lester yawned like a lion, revealing a dull steel ball pierced through his tongue. Iacone, roused from sleep for this, yawned in response. "But I'll tell you, man, I'm really worried about my girlfriend. I gave her $100 to get me something, you know, get me well. She said 15 minutes and left me standing there 3 hours. I had no idea where she went or what happened to her. 15 minutes. I mean, I never would have done that if she didn't leave me there like half the night watching everybody coming out of that place for smokes, drunker and drunker, half the damn bags right on the sidewalk." Another titanic yawn, the dirty, dull tongue pierced winking. "Sucks," Iacone said. Strapped for a partner, Matty had cajoled him out of his permanent bunk room with the promise of overtime and an easy commute. "I mean, I'm screwed, I know it, but can you just check your computer, see if she's in the system? I'm hoping she's just got collared, nothing worse, but..." "What's her name?" "Anita Castro or Carla Nieves." Iacone rose and went to the computer on Yolanda's desk. "Where'd you get $100, Lester?" Matty asked. "Where?" He shivered, then coughed into his fist. "Oh, man, you don't want to make extra work for yourself with questions like that." "No? Seriously?" Matty let it slide. "Nothing," Iacone called out. "Did you check Brooklyn?" "No, just Manhattan." "Can you check Brooklyn? She scores on South 2nd, South 3rd. No one scores in Manhattan anymore. Manhattan's dead. You guys took care of that." Lester recrossed his knees, the slice of grimy red long john peeking out between his pale blue ankle and the cuff of his jeans. "I mean, what the hell happened to her? She was going to take me to the hospital. I have fluid in my lungs." "That's no problem. We'll get someone to take you as soon as we're finished." "Nothing," Iacone called out. "She got a third name?" "She's not in the system, huh? Jesus, what do you think happened to her?" he asked Matty. and me here. This is a felony too, right? Not necessarily. Depends how you say what you say. You know, vis-a-vis sincerity, remorse. I am remorseful. I didn't menace. I didn't threaten. I didn't say anything, what's it, terroristic. All right, just capture that in your statement. In fact, if you want, we can even write your statement for you. But Lester, what can I tell you that you haven't heard a million times before? You help us, we help. You think this could go down as a pet law? I picked the thing up off the sidewalk. I didn't even think anybody was going to notice. When that big black guy started running after me, I was like, here, take it. I didn't even get to open the damn thing. I have no idea what was in there. Obviously, I'm not a pro at this. Now, don't get down on yourself, Iacone said from Yolanda's desk. You know, I got to say right now, we're pretty much eating out of garbage cans, me and Anita. But a few years ago, we had us a store worth like $200,000. Oh, yeah? Maddie's turned to Yorn. What kind of store? It was like a punk boutique? No kidding. Can I have a cigarette? Jesus, I got to get to the emergency room. All right, Maddie clapped his hands. Here we go. One-time offer. The hell with the guys who shot that kid. Just give us a stick-up team. Just some names. Anybody you know works the hood. They check out. Not only do you get a pass here, we take you to the ER, get you squared away, and then we go look for your girl. A stick-up team? Lester shrugged, recrossed his legs, looked away. You know, she used to use Carmen Lopez. That's a professional name at this one place out in Massapequa. She's a bar dancer, exotic, very good, very popular. I had her regulars, guys who like to see her. And she could go to their houses, some of them, borrow $30, $40, but she's 4 months pregnant now, so. Resting his brow on the curve of his free hand. I don't know. Maybe it's time to go upstate. It's getting too hot out here, you know.
Richard Price, reading a junkie's aria from Lush Life. It's beautiful. Thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thanks.
You can read an excerpt from Lush Life at kcrw.com/bookworm. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Associate producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book. The mouse clock time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.